Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that sound. Wiggling.
Yeah, this is Cassidy the Hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dallas, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey, what it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
Alrighty, alrighty. We are episode 519. Off the Cuff Radio, live and direct. I'm your host, King Eric, the Media Assassin. And this show is sponsored by Fleetwood and the Cot Pickers, Cocaine's Buddy Boy Entertainment, Jesse Boutique, Vinci Clothing, Core Financial. I got my host T-Max with the facts on the line. What's good, my man?
What's going on, man? Look, we are back at it once again, live and direct. OT Skip in the building. Shout out to our co-host, the Lost Man, L.H. and Chiller. And, of course, the pilot in charge of First Class Fresh, King Eric, and I'm the co-pilot, T-Max, with the facts on this wonderful Wild Out Wednesday. In a long line of shows we've done over the years, this show is especially special tonight. To call our guest legendary is an understatement. To call her a trailblazer is being modest. This woman is the epitome of class excellence, education, enlightenment. Anything academic that has to do with the music industry, this young lady is synonymous with. And if you know your worth in hip-hop in terms of the history, then you know the name Wendy Day and how she has brightened up so many people, giving her time, her persistence, her courageousness, her counsel, her compassion, her wit, her wisdom. We at Off the Cuff Radio over the years have done so many legendary shows, and she tonight being our esteemed guest, which we are so honored to have on, is another championship chapter to the book and the pantheon of greatness that we began, but so many of our guests previously, including her, have helped author in terms of our awesomeness. She's here to tell her story. Ladies and gentlemen,
we're going to roll the dice here, man, because this number is calling from a 917 number. Now, if this is her,
okay.
Welcome aboard. If not, we'll just do the drum roll again.
Okay, 917.
Wow, that was an awesome, awesome introduction. I'm glad this is radio and you can't see my face because I'm blushing. What an awesome introduction. Thank you so much. How are you guys?
We're blessed.
We are well. How are you?
I'm awesome. I'm so happy to be here tonight.
Wendy,
yes,
I mean, this
yes.
is an honor. I mean, man, you have no idea.
It's an honor for me. Episode 519. Like, dude, you guys have been doing this forever. I love it.
Yes, yes, yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, when King told me that you were coming on with us, I was like, whoa. Because Dory's, your history speaks for itself in terms
of crazy,
everything.
Right?
That you, yes. Yes, it has. I mean, your achievements, your accomplishments, your contributions still going to this day. I mean, I don't know if we really have enough time over 2 hours to really cover appropriately everything that you've done, but we're damn sure going to try.
Tell you this. Now, I'm going to tell you guys this. What made me want to reach out to her was the book that she made on 2011 titled The Knowledge to Succeed. That book was an eye-opener on how a lot of people need to know the ins and outs of this business. And unfortunately, I lost the book when I moved in 2012, but the knowledge was already instilled. I'm like, we got to get this woman someday because she helped a lot of people, a lot of your favorite rappers and those who listen and get a lot of good deals. And she's been a trailblazer. So the floor is yours to have. We're welcome to Off the Cuff Radio.
Let's get it.
So much. Thank you so much. That's just, I'm humbled, truly humbled.
I guess we go to the genesis like Nas or Illmatic, you know, with all the automatic. Please tell us about yourself, you know, how you got started. I mean, you know, what inspired you? Yes, please, go ahead.
What inspired me really is the music. I started listening to rap music in 1980. So I guess I just showed you how old I was. Back when I used to ride my dinosaur, I would listen to whatever the latest music was that was coming out of New York. I was born and raised in Philadelphia, so I was living in Philly at the time, and I was in college, and I went to a concert at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and at that concert...
Go Quakers!
Right? At that concert was Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And I had just never seen anything like that. I was so amazed and impressed with their content and their passion and the, you know, the synchronized dancing that they were doing on the stage. It was just, it was incredible to me. And from there, I went on to one of the record stores in Philadelphia, because back then, you know, everything came out through record stores. And I found a DJ that worked at the record store spinning music, and he loved rap too. So we kind of became fast friends because we had the music in common. And he had a cousin in New York that used to send him cassette tapes. This is how long ago it was. Cassette tapes down from New York from the weekend before, and I would buy copies from him. And then, of course, as vinyl was coming out from the smaller independent labels in New York, I was buying the music to bring home and listen to. So it was just an amazing time. Round about 1987, so 7 years later, I went to New York for a weekend, and I heard the Mr. Magic Marley Marl radio show. And I loved that radio show so much that I went home, quit my job in Philly, packed up a U-Haul, and moved to New York. I moved to New York within, like, literally a week and a half. And that was it for me. I didn't work in the industry yet, but I was in the clubs every night, and I was really just loving rap music. It was just, my whole life was about being in the clubs and hearing the new music and just really enjoying myself. I didn't start working in the music industry till 1992, and I started Rap Coalition because I didn't like hearing about how some of my favorite artists were being unfairly taken advantage of. So I started Rap Coalition as a reaction to artists being taken advantage of so that I could help pull people out of bad deals for free. And that was 30 years ago. And Nothing's changed. I do now have a for-profit company as well as a not-for-profit, and the for-profit company, Power Moves, we help build successful careers for artists in the music industry when they've got investors on board that can help market and promote them financially to the next level. And I got to tell you, I can't stop. I thought maybe I would do this for 5 years, and it's been 30, and it went by so fast.
Man.
Yeah, especially when you come in around that time, because you started the Rap Coalition in 1992, and that was when you started seeing the apex of new talent emerging. Like, it started a new renaissance.
Yeah. Yeah, it started coming in from the West Coast at that point in time. I mean, there was always rap on the West Coast, but that's when, like, Cypress Hill started to really explode. And then not long after that, you know, the whole Death Row era came into play. Of course, prior to that was all of NWA and Ice-T. So there was always rap outside of New York. But it's kind of when people started to accept it commercially.
You know, it's wild, Wendy, because, and thank you so much for mentioning Ice-T, because we've said this on so many shows, because a lot of people think about NWA as being, you know, the pioneers of West Coast rap. They were just the ones to really kick down the door for it. But Ice-T, you know, Ron Page was released in 86. You know, a couple of years before Straight Outta Compton was released. And, of course, going back to your, you know, Philadelphia roots, Ice-T will tell you himself. Shameless plug, for those that have not read the book Split Decision by Douglas Century that with Spike and Ice, go get it. Because Spike, you know, because Ice-T mentions this, that a lot of his style came from Schoolie D when he first started out, you know, before he actually, you know, really developed his own. But we just wanted to throw that in there. Wendy, when you saw the game really, when you saw hip-hop really begin to flourish, I mean, this is, your inception came in 80. So you're watching all of this come in terms of the rise of Def Jam, you know, this young, you know, 15-year-old, you know, Todd James Smith, you know, everybody knows him as LL today. You know, Cool J. You're watching, you know, the Fat Boys, you know, the Beastie Boys, you know, UTFO. You're watching all of these artists.
All that.
Really be, yes. When you saw that movement coming, of course, KRS, Public Enemy will come later. When you saw this movement bubbling, did you know what it was going to end up becoming in terms of the cultural phenomenon, not only in the United States, but worldwide, that it would end up being?
No. I don't think anybody knew what it would actually become. I knew that it was important, and I knew that it mattered, and I knew that the record labels thought that it was a fad, so I knew it was not a fad. But did I think that 30 years later it would be the number one genre in music? No. Did I know that it would be used in commercials and movies and TV? No. I never thought it would be as big as it's gotten, but I knew that it wasn't a fad.
And pretty much when you, what was your, in terms of watching the deal, because, you know, it was still nascent in terms of how we saw the business began to really kind of, it was still in its nascent phase, so we really didn't quite understand yet how the business was conducted in terms of how contracts were, you know, how artists, you know, in terms of your points, in terms of album deals, in terms of how many you contribute, I mean, budgeting. Pretty much people possibly had an idea going back to the days with Elvis, you know, James Brown, you know, rest in peace, you know, Jerry Heller. He talked about how, you know, with guys like, you know, Nat Turnpool, about those old guys, about how they would shake down guys like Jackie Wilson and all of them, you know, in terms of how their record contracts weren't the best. And this was going back to like the 50s and 60s.
Right.
When did you start seeing the shady side of the deals? You, of course, We're not going to ask you to name any artist or the label that was involved in it. But when did you start seeing certain situations with artists where the deal wasn't all the way right in terms of what was being asked of them and what they were getting in return?
Well, when I moved to New York, because I was going to the clubs and I was starting to meet the artists, I would hear them talking about their deals, and I would hear them talking about how the only money they were making was to be in the club, you know, the show money. And
right.
So it wasn't hidden. I mean, the fan base back in the 80s, in the late 80s, was pretty small. So we all kind of knew each other, kind of bumped into each other at the clubs. There weren't that many artists the way there are today. You know, now there's millions of rappers. Back then, there weren't millions of rappers. So everybody kind of knew who was coming up, you know, who was at a point where they were getting discovered, who was just starting out. You know, everybody kind of knew who was who. So the Source magazine was like the Bible of hip-hop back then. And they would tell a lot of stories. Artists would give interviews and talk about how they weren't really being paid properly, their contracts weren't right. And then I took a course at the New School in New York in 1991, which is what made me want to start Rap Coalition. And I learned in that class that artists were, like, people would help artists as long as they had the money to pay them. But when an artist was in a messed up situation and they couldn't afford to pay a lawyer or an accountant to help them anymore, that those resources would dry up for them. And I just felt like that wasn't fair. I felt like when somebody needed help most, there should be resources there to help them. And I thought, well, shit, why not me? Like, if somebody's going to do it, I trust myself to do it. I know that I'm going to do the right thing. Let me put up my own money, show the world that there's a need for this. And if for some reason I don't like it or I was wrong and there's not a need for this, I'll just go get a job and do something else. So I didn't really see the risk in starting Rap Coalition at all. And from day one, there was a need for it, you know? I never had to advertise. Everything was word of mouth. And even today, when an artist is in a messed up situation, they somehow come through my office. Not everybody is ready to really do what they need to do in order to renegotiate their deal. A lot of people really just want to complain. But those who do get the help they need, and we still, in 2022, we don't charge for that side of our services. That's still not the problem.
Man.
Hold on one second. We got our friend Pittsburgh Pat on the line. He want to ask you a couple questions.
Pat, what's good, man?
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey, Pat, how are you?
I'm great, Wendy. It's an honor to talk to you. I've been doing radio now for about like seven or eight years. I actually got my start through one of the guys from Murder Dog Magazine, and you've always been somebody that I have like an immense respect for. Like, I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I don't really know the reason, but like growing up before like Cash Money and No Limit got nationally known, for some reason, like, those were the rappers that were in my city. Like, I knew UNLV and Magnolia Slim, and I have like Juvenile albums from before he was on Cash Money.
From before
so
Cash
you
Money,
did,
yeah.
Yeah, the Being Myself album. I still have it to this day. But first, I just want to thank you for what you did for New Orleans. You know, you had, your fingerprints are all over No Limit and Cash Money's success. And, you know, growing up when nobody else knew who they were and we knew that they were superstars, like, it meant a lot to us knowing that, like, we've known them forever and to see them get their shine. You know what I mean? So, like, that's where my respect started with you. That was my introduction to you. And I've just, you know, I now I know I always watch your interviews. And, you know, like I just want to thank you in general just for everything you've done. Yeah, I'm familiar with like pretty much everything you've done. So, but I wanted to jump in because of what you were talking about. See, we've talked about this before. Like nowadays, yeah, there's more resources and everything, and you can get your name out there. But like we talk about it, like with just being a radio show, like when we hit a guest up, we have to make sure that we make it clear that we're not a radio show because our phone has a record button, which, I mean, there is people that just record stuff and act like they're a podcast or a show, and they don't really put the effort in, they don't put the work in, and there's just so many fish in the sea. So
yeah.
One of the questions I have is a problem that, like, a lot of artists run into is they're kind of naive. Like, let's say I'm a rapper and you hear my music and you think I'm incredible, but I have no budget. How far is my talent alone going to get me in this business?
Nowhere.
Good question.
Okay.
Nowhere.
So I wanted to see, like, when I tell people that, they look at me like I'm hating on them or anything like that. I want them to hear that from your mouth with somebody that knows the game better than anybody. And, yeah, that's the importance. Like I said, with more resources, there is more ways to get your name heard of, but you got to outwork. I mean, everybody's a rapper now. You know what I mean? Like, and
if
you have
a rapper.
You got to stand out. You got to be separated from the pack and understand it. You got to treat it like it's a job. You know, and just being dope isn't enough. Like a million people are dope. You know.
I've been doing this for 30 years, and I never saw somebody get signed to a label or build a fan base just because they were dope. It's a business, and just like you wouldn't start a restaurant and not have money to buy food, not have a chef to cook, and not advertise or market your restaurant, you shouldn't do that in the music industry either.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That's a great way to put it.
You've got to stand out, especially today. There's, you know, I looked at a research website called Chartmetric before I got on the show tonight, and they have a list of over 4 million rappers, and they rank them in order of popularity, which is crazy to me. But if you're going to come out in a world where there's already millions of rappers, and we all know there's 60,000 uploads to Spotify every day, how are you going to stand out from that?
Yeah. Absolutely. Exactly. You have to, you know, there's technique involved. Being dope, it just isn't enough. That's a very small ingredient, like, to be honest with you. I mean, you have to get to a point where your talent is going to have, you know, you're going to have to stand on your talent. Yes, but there's a million things you got to do. Example I like to give is the Griselda dudes from Buffalo. They've been dope for years. They've been dope for 15, 20 years. But once they got their money up, they built a little following in Buffalo, and they had the money to invest into their careers, and now that's why they took that next step. Like, their talent could have got them on a small stage in Buffalo probably for the rest of their lives, but just Buffalo. You know, once they got their money up and was able to invest in themselves and had a budget, you know, that now look where they are. They're making it somewhere. But they've been dope for years, you know. And a lot of artists are like that. But
yep, it's
true. You know, I'm glad to ask you that question, because, like I said, I can't think of somebody better to ask that question. You know, like, I knew the answer, but like I wanted everybody to hear that, because there's so many fish in the sea that, I mean, you know, there's a million shows bigger than us. But I'm tired of people just posting their link on my page, like, listen to me. It's like, man, I get that all the time. Like, I don't even listen anymore. You know what I mean? It's like, that's not doing enough. That's not real promo. You're pressing a button. Like, you got to get yourself out there and put money into your career. If you don't, you're just you're just going to be that Facebook rapper for the rest of your life. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Like, if you're going to be a rapper and you want people to hear your music, you've got to market and promote yourself to the point where people want to hear you. And then when an artist comes to me through another resource, or I hear their music myself somewhere and I see that they're really working and they're really trying, that's where I get interested. I don't get interested in somebody that just spams me music.
Yeah.
Do that. Monkey could do that.
Exactly. And I mean, right now we could all download an app on our phone and find an instrumental and record a song right now and put it on SoundCloud. Are we rappers now? Like, you know what I mean? And like, that's what a lot of people do. They just kind of try to replicate what they're hearing every day, make a SoundCloud, share it to Facebook, and think that I'm going to blow up one day. Like,
they're doing
Yeah, no, not at all. But I told these guys, unfortunately, I don't have much time. I have my niece here. It's a school night and stuff, so that's why I kind of got, I kind of got a roll here soon. But I had to talk to you for a second. And my co-host here, they're great hosts, and I'm sure that they're gonna ask you all kinds of great questions too. So I figured for my last question for you, let's just make it a fun one. You're a hip-hop head yourself. Who's your top five that are alive?
Wow, that's a great question, and it really changes a lot.
Mine as well.
I listen to so much music. So right now, I've been listening to Razzcaz a lot. His early stuff from the 90s, I love.
He was just on the show. Yeah.
I love it. I'm just back from Hyro Day in Oakland. So I've been listening to a lot of Hyro. Like Souls of Mischief. I'm working with LaRussell right now from the Bay Area. So I've been listening to a lot of LaRussell's music.
Of course.
I read an article this morning that Future just did a deal to sell his publishing. So today I've been listening to a lot of Future. So today he's in my top five. So you see, it kind of changes based on my life and what's going on. I did a conference call tonight and heard some music by one of my clients, Ugly Face. So they're in my car right now. You know, that's what I'm listening to. I'm driving around and listening to their new music. So my top five really changes based on what I'm working on. But if I had to say my favorite rappers of all time, I still love Rakim. I love early Jeezy. I love Razzcaz. I'm drawing a blank. But that's pretty much like my Biggie. I love Biggie. I'm from New York. So I'm a huge Biggie fan. And Eminem. Yeah, I think Eminem is one of the best to ever do it. So there, that's fine.
That's a great answer. It's different, unique, and, I mean, it's hard to argue against it, too. You got a lot of legends in there. I mean, you know, I'm a diehard Biggie fan, a Soulja Slim fan. I like Jay-Z. You know, I like stuff like Sheebo and the Dayton family and, you know, Beanie Siegel, Jada Kiss, Koji Rap.
Yep.
Yeah, I know what you mean, though.
UGK is amazing.
Who?
UGK.
Oh, I love UGK. I was just about to say Pimp C and Bun B. I love them as solos and as a duo, you know. I love Pimp C.
Yep.
My guy, you know, but yeah, I understand what you mean, though. Like, we're about to go into, we're going to interview, like, a guy I know that, yeah, he's been making some noise in his, you know, he has a nice little following going for the past couple of years. His name's Mr. Cisco, and he's from, I think, right outside of Detroit. But I have a lot of relationships with, like, artists from Detroit and Texas. Yeah, like the old school Rap A Lot guys, you know, like Gangsta Nip and like 20 to Life and K Reno and all those guys. But in Michigan, I know like Isham and the Dayton family and all those guys. And whenever I start to do more Detroit interviews and stuff, I'll fall into like a Detroit phase. And Awesome Dre from Detroit was the first dude to like I listened to that I knew I would just like rap forever. And I got to interview him and stuff. And like, to me, that's, I mean, you might not hear him in the people's top tens and stuff, but like, to me, like, he means the world to me forever just because he was just so raw at the right time for me, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
But I know what you mean by, like, just depending on what you're doing, you kind of slip in and out. And, you know, when we go on this Michigan run, I'll be listening to a lot of Detroit and Flint stuff and be like, oh, yeah, man, these guys are in my top five, even though a month ago I gave a whole different top five, you know what I mean? So I totally feel you.
Big Herc. Do you remember Big Herc from Detroit?
I interviewed him. He has a son now, Little Herc. He raps too, but I interviewed Herc a few years back. Yeah, he's great. Him and Camp Town actually did an interview with us. But yeah, that's great. You gave Herc a shout out. Shout out to Big Herc. But
definitely.
But Wendy, I'm gonna go ahead and hand this back over to my co-host. I don't want to underestimate. I don't want you to underestimate how much I respect you. And I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of legends. And this is like a true, like, it's an honor. It's like a bucket list item. Like,
oh,
you know, you're somebody I have an immense amount of respect for. And I mean that with every bit of sincerity I can give you. So
thank you
so much for coming on our show, for real.
Of course. Thank you.
But, hey, you guys
take it easy.
Thanks for letting me on real quick. And, again, Wendy, thank you for everything, for all your contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Have a good night, everybody. Thanks again.
You too, Pat. Always great to hear from you. It's always great to hear Pat when he comes on.
Oh,
wait.
I want to shoot this tour here because the future situation gave me an inclination on what to ask. Now, I want to know, what are your thoughts on artists selling their catalog? Do you see any valuability in new music in 2022?
Yes. I mean, definitely. Music has tremendous value. The reason a lot of artists are selling their catalogs right now is because publishing's value is at an all-time high. It's sort of like if you had a Lamborghini and your Lamborghini was worth, let's say, $200,000, but somebody was willing to pay you $450,000 for it, it's almost like you do the deal because what you can do with that money is going to far extend beyond what you could do with your publishing if you hung on to it. So publishing right now is selling at 8 times to 20 times its value. And that's really, really, really high. So guys like Future, or even the older artists like Fleetwood Mac, or, you know, Bob Dylan, the reason they're doing these deals is because the value of the money that they can get now, they can do more with that money today while they're alive than they can just passing on their publishing to their, you know, to their estate or their family. And that's why these guys are doing the deals. When I first heard that people were selling their publishing, I thought they were crazy. So I started really researching it to find out why. Because, you know, it's been too many people over the years now that are doing it. I'm like, okay, I must be missing something. So as I did the research, I realized that it's just really overvalued. And that doesn't mean that it'll drop, but the chances are good that at some point it will. So it's sort of like having, you want to cash out because, and it doesn't mean you cash out and you go trick off the money. It means you cash out and you buy other investments that are growing faster than publishing with that money. That's what that means.
Yeah. And when we thought about it, Wendy, because when we look at it, and King made a great point because when we see that, we're seeing, especially with
you know, hip-hop culture, black urban culture at an all-time high in terms of fashion, in terms of worldwide influence, from music to dress, you know, everything. And definitely the music, when you see artists where they're, shout out to Sherrod G of his organization, you know, Minority Golf Association, because we had him on a few months back, and he said, you know, you don't have anything that's worth selling if you're not selling it. And he made a point about it, because if you have a position where you can build it to sell it, that's what you do. And with a lot of artists, we think about it from a perspective of they work, they put all this time in, all the sacrifice, and we know a little bit about it in terms of having your mechanical royalties, your publishing, in terms of making sure you're getting residual income. But then after a while, you think about it, you know, I've put in for all of this, you know, I've made my money to a degree, but maybe I can really get a bag off of this in terms of really getting a big payout in terms of, you know, will I own it essentially anymore? No, but I get a hell of a compensation package for it. You think about what Irv Gotti did, you know, when, you know, with Murder, Inc., you know, when he got, you know, his deal. And we were
exactly.
Like, wow, I'm like, and he's getting all this money, you know what I'm saying, to, you know, basically a line of credit as well, you know, to, you know, develop film and television. We got to take it back to the root, though, before we get way ahead. When you look at how the game started in terms of music, because we see a lot of it now in terms of where it is just, and King knows this, my brother knows this, I've not listened to the radio in roughly about 20 years. I mean, after payola came, in terms of, well, actually, payola was illegal, but then it kind of became, after the radio stations were bought out by the corporations, and then the corporations worked with the record labels, so now they get a playlist, and they got to play the same song. All of, what was it like back in the day to hear DJs, in terms of their core job, breaking in records that were actually dope, that actually resonated with the people, that actually moved the crowd?
For me, it was awesome. I thought it was amazing to hear other people that love the culture as much as I do, like really doing their thing, you know? And that was super special. There are still some DJs out here that play music that they love because they love it. But for mm-hmm. the most part, it really is a business. And it's
right.
kind of about the money. And we all know, you know, we've all heard songs that we didn't like when we heard them, but we learned that if we heard them enough, we'd start singing along and they'd start to, like, grow on us. So we all know that bad music can be pushed to another level. Does that make it right? No, certainly
Ooh,
not.
Ooh, are we
but
seeing that today? Ooh.
It's a business, so it really does happen, and it's unfortunate, but if the fans would react by not supporting the bullshit, there would be no bullshit. The only reason there's
Absolutely.
Bullshit is because the bullshit makes money.
And there's and when you think about it back in the day, when the Source magazine, shout out to Dave Mays and John Schechter, you know, who started in 1988. I actually still have the first flyer, you know, it's the
old
wow. issue from 99. Yeah, that was actually, it was a replica copy from the 1999 issue of the double cover with Queen Latifah and Q-Tip. And I actually still have that issue. For shameless
That's
promotion
amazing.
Of my magazine collection. I have to say it again on air. I have pretty much every Source magazine since 1994 from when I started reading, and every XXL from when I started reading in 1997. The only XXL I do not have is the sneak preview issue with Big on the cover, and I'm gonna hunt that down and get it.
Awesome. You'll find it. You'll find it somewhere.
Yeah. Thank God for eBay.
Right?
But yeah. But when you think about how this, when the Source started coming in, and even before that with Word Up Magazine, shout out to John Blaston Game, we're going to have him on Friday. They were really in earnest, the two publications that really focused on hip-hop culture and, you know, R&B, you know, soul music, you know, exclusively. So we're looking at
right.
these two public. How big was, back in the day, what did it take for an artist to even get that notoriety in terms of getting in a publication?
Well, they had to have something going on because in the early days you couldn't buy your way in the way you can today.
Mm-hmm.
So you had
right.
to really, and that was because it was very competitive. And if the magazines put in artists that nobody had ever heard of, they would get blasted on. So the magazines had to kind of keep it a buck in order to be taken seriously and be able to build their reputation and their brand. So authenticity really matters. That doesn't mean there wasn't one or two that slipped through the cracks, but the ones that slipped through the cracks were people that had been around for a while, or there was some reason they were being talked about. Either they did some good for the community, or you know, they got in trouble or arrested or, you know, whatever. But in order to get into a magazine, you had to have some skill level and you had to be bumbling around on the underground for a while. You couldn't just start rapping on a Tuesday and be up in Source Magazine on Thursday. It didn't work that way.
Hmm.
You had to prove yourself. It was competitive, very competitive.
Especially now, because now you have what we would consider, I don't know if you're familiar with this term, but are you familiar with the term industry plants, where it seems
yeah.
like the industry just plants certain individuals with a fabricated fan base, fabricated numbers, like you don't hear nothing from this guy or this gal, and they just blow up, you know what I'm saying, like overnight, like, you never heard this song on the radio, or...
Yeah, we're like, how did that happen?
Yeah. Like, you can create these stars. Like, are you familiar with the term industry plant?
I am. Yep. I am. I don't know how realistic it is. I don't know if they exist or not. But I do know that if the industry wanted to do that, they could do that.
And when we look at it too, Wendy, you know... especially the generation King and myself come from, because, you know, he's 40, I'm 44. We come from a time where we actually saw an authentic growth, an organic evolution of an artist's development. You know, we watched, you know, LL from 15 years old become, you know, this actor icon, you know, MC. We watched Snoop Dogg start out on Deep Cover in 92, and we lovingly, affectionately, you know, as all of us do in the culture, refer to him as Uncle Snoop now, you know.
Yeah.
Snoop, you know, we saw the Ghetto Boys when they started, you know, with, you know, Making Trouble was the first album, of course, but Grip It on that other level was the album that really... I remember years ago when that album dropped and MTV was talking about how wild that album was.
Right.
You know, we saw, you know, Mary J. Blige singing in Father MC's I'll Be Good to You in the background. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so we watched a lot of these artists grow.
Yeah, we knew who they were and where they came from. They didn't just come out of nowhere. They weren't, you know, products of SoundCloud or TikTok. And that's not to down that. I know that a lot of our generation don't like the new music. But the great thing about hip-hop is if you stick around for a couple years, it's going to change. It changes every 3 to 5 years. You know, the sound changes, the players change, the way we market changes. You know, it's just the evolution is very quick. And I'm thankful for that, because if I don't like something, it changes quickly. And, you know, like I remember as a hip-hop purist, I remember when they gave the very first Grammy Award in rap to Fresh Prince, the industry
1989.
Was, yeah, like we were disgusted by that because we saw him as a sellout. And that's really funny to think about now because look how far Will Smith has come. Well, the mentality has changed and the thinking has changed, and now he's a legend and an icon. But yep. I remember writing an article for Source Magazine talking about how I threw a brick at my TV because this commercial pop star won Best Rapper.
He was building a house in a house. Good Lord. I mean, but when you think about it, though, that time period, rap was still somewhat of an underground phenomenon. It was relegated strictly for street culture.
Yeah.
You know, when we first heard Will, you know, we first heard their first album, you know, it was like, you know, we first heard Brand New Funk in 87, you know, we were like, whoa, just like when we first heard Hammer, you know, Feel My Power, you know, back in 87, 86, 87, when his first album dropped. You know, so
yeah.
We saw a situation where the sonic, the sensibilities of it were rooted in a very in-your-face boom-bap style that would define the better part of the first 10 to 15 years of the game. So we
right.
looked at it as when the game began to shift. In the 90s, that's when we saw the rise of gangster rap, of course. You know, N.W.A. had kicked the door down with it. Cube had left, did America's Most Wanted with the Bomb Squad, just was a seismic, just time bomb, no pun intended. It just detonated on the industry. Of course, you know, Ice-T was already well into the game, you know, so he had dropped a couple more albums by then, you know, with Power. And, you know, he was rolling. I mean, of course, Compton's Most Wanted, you know, King T, you know, DJ Quick, all within this from 1986 to 1992, this six-year span, we are just seeing the game kind of go from it was street-oriented, but then it got to a more edgy part. And then how can I be remiss when we talk about the late 80s when we're talking about the Afrocentric movement, of course.
Yeah.
ARS-1, X-Clan.
Yes.
You had Boogie Down. I mean, yeah, Poor Righteous Teachers, you know, YZ, you know, was part of that. I mean, Queen Latifah, you know,
yep.
was doing her thing, you know. So this is like, you know, Native Tongues, you know, Tribe Called Quest, Native Tongues were forming, you know, De La Soul. You know, so we're seeing these different phases of the black, you know, / African-American experience go from, you know, from the round the way MC and ciphering to the consciousness, the awakening of our minds, to going to the harder street edge.
Right.
And there was still something that at the time there was a sentiment, there was a paradigm of this was just for us. And it wasn't necessarily about color. It was just about no matter who you were, black, brown, white, if you could just appreciate the music at its core. But once a lot of people felt the media, the quote-unquote popular culture got a hold of it, then that's when it would be, yeah, mainstream, thank you. It would be compromised.
Yeah. Yeah. And now I'm hugely thankful for the fact that it went mainstream. But back then, being a purist, I hated it. I hated
right.
that they were making Fruity Pebbles commercials out of rap. You know, it was almost like they were sanctioning gimmicks.
Right. Right. But it was something as we moved on.
One-on-one, I ain't like seeing, and I love
Hammer
him, man. I love him to death. But I ain't like seeing Hammer dance for chicken. I ain't like that commercial.
I thought he was gonna say that.
Right.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah. We thought at that time when it came down, especially with the stigma of black people and fried chicken. You know, it's something that, you know, do we love it? Absolutely. But we've seen that too many times in racial tropes that, you know, came to be dangerously stereotypical and even flat-out racist. And during that time
right.
in the 90s, we were seeing so many elements that were, I think at that time, still cutting edge for the moment, where we were not ready as a society to move forward with it. I listened,
I mean, I look at an album, you know, like America's Most Wanted and Death Certificate, a Cube drop, and that was hard then. I'm like, some of these people today, if that album dropped today, I think they might have a heart attack behind
them.
That's funny.
They might have a heart attack behind that. I mean, over 30 years later, and those records still are like, wow.
Still hit, yep.
When you see how that shift started and when the money started coming in, and there were a few, shout out Uncle Life, you know, who were really on the block, who really had it, but when you really started seeing a lot of artists making more money, what did you see from an artist perspective of creativity? What did you see from a perspective of fiscal responsibility that was changing?
I saw a lot of artists that were making a lot of money, especially show money, and mm-hmm. not understanding how to hang on to it. You know, they didn't understand what investment was. They didn't understand that you need multiple streams of income to be able to sustain any type of wealth. And a lot of artists that, you know, made money in the 80s and the 90s spent it just as quickly as they made it, thinking it would last forever, and then it didn't. And that became a problem.
That part.
Because they didn't have a way to keep it coming in as they grew. You know, their popularity waned, and another generation of artists came into, you know, into popularity, and they weren't able to keep up. And a lot of the older artists became really bitter because they felt like they created this art form and didn't really profit from it. And that's both sad and discouraging. You know, we never set up a retirement plan for the founders of hip hop.
And it's crazy you say that, Wendy, because when we look at it from that stand, I know this could be controversial. People will probably want to flame me in the comments when we put this on YouTube. We look at how the shift was changing in the 90s, of course, with hip-hop really becoming dominant. The legend Michael Jackson, as great as he was, even with Michael, you know, where Michael was running the 80s, you know, Michael in the 90s, you know, while he still, you know, made good music, you know, it was beginning to change where even with Michael, he wasn't necessarily the focal point of the music industry anymore. As you said, there are elements of it when it begins to change and people are seeing what is becoming more of a resonant voice in the current climate of a demographic that is burgeoning, that becomes their expression. That is their, that's their outlet. And we
right.
saw that. And, you know, just like, and I'm a diehard heavy metal, thrash metal fan as well. It's like in the 90s when we saw, you know, Nirvana come to prominence. You know, I remember, I will never forget it. This was years ago over my aunt's house, and I was watching Headbangers Ball one night. And this is the last video that they had showed on this previous night in 1991. It was in a gym. Then I hear that, dong, da dong, da dong, da dong, da dong, da dong, da dong. And I'm like, what the hell? Then the guitars, and I'm like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I was like, I do not know who. I just saw Nevermind, Nirvana. Then I saw an MTV's graphic, lower left-hand corner. For all of my nostalgia, 80s, 90s babies, you know what it is. Then I saw that it said Nirvana, Nevermind. You know, Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit, album Nevermind, DGC Records. After I heard that song, Wendy, I swear to God, I was like, these motherfuckers are going to be huge. I didn't
and
know what
changed,
I just heard, but
and
I was,
it changed your life. It changed a lot of fans' lives.
Yeah,
you know,
but it like,
it was
but
special.
It, but a
the
lot
moment.
Of people, yeah, it did. And also, but by the same token, for the metalheads, it was also considered the kiss of death for heavy metal and thrash metal in terms of being the big thing, because this is where alternative metal, you know, alternative rock was coming in, which had already been around. When you go back to Soundgarden in the late 80s, you had Alice in Chains in the early 90s. You had Pearl Jam, Mother Love Bone, all of them. So this was not – once. So basically, but Nirvana, when they dropped Nevermind, that was the watershed moment that would end up changing it, where you have, like you have bands like Blind Melon, a lot of other bands that would come behind them as well. When we look at the game of how videos were done, in terms of what went into it once you started seeing artists getting signed, in terms of deals they were getting, in terms of their budgets, what their albums were like, in terms of how much they were supposed to tell us, however you want to break it down, what the average record contract looks like for an artist coming in, signing up.
It would really depend on their leverage. So an artist that had a tremendous amount of leverage was able to get a bigger advance. And just like today, I mean, it's always been based on the bean counters, the accounting department, when you would meet with a label and they were going to sign you, the opposing side always knows how high they can go. And they know not to go over that, because there's a guy in an office somewhere with a calculator that can do forecasts and can figure out how much the artist is worth, how much they're going to sell, how much money they're going to make in their career, you know, what the low end and the high end is. So when you're sitting there negotiating a deal, of course, you don't know that when you're negotiating against the label, but they have a figure they're not going to go over. And if there's a bidding war and that figure gets crossed, they're gonna stop negotiating. They're gonna let somebody else have it, because they're never going to forecast against themselves, meaning they're not gonna lose money. They're gonna make sure they're gaining market share, and they're gonna make sure they're gaining income. And nothing has changed. So in the 90s, when the deals were a little bit more lucrative, it was because they were selling discs that they were pressing for 23 cents for $19.99 retail. You know, they were making $12 in, I think it was $12.63, if I remember exactly the wholesale price. So the markup was incredible. When it went to streaming, not so much. So they're still making money today, but it's not the same as it was in the 90s with CDs. So the business model has changed, but the profitability has not. So labels still are mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead. Labels still are doing deals only when they win, and only when they win big. So if they have to sign an artist and spend $10 to make 11 back, they're not going to do it. But if they can sign an artist where they spend $10 and make 20 back, they're going to do that all day.
And that's where you started seeing a lot of artists in the 90s really start blowing up, especially off of gangster rap, because it was dangerous, it was edgy, and that's when you started
what the suburban fans wanted.
Exactly.
You know, I remember back in the 90s, I remember having a conversation with Talib Kweli, because he was, you know, Black Star and Talib were signed to a label, Raucous Records, and they really had a decent budget. And so many artists used to say back in the day that the gangster rappers got bigger budgets because the labels wanted to destroy Black culture. And I remember thinking, you know, as a white person, I remember thinking, wow, if that's true, that's the most fucked up shit I've ever heard. And as I got closer to the inner circle and the business side, I realized that the label didn't care what you rapped about as long as you made them money. That's what they cared about. They cared about the profitability of music. And the fact that the fans were the ones that were, you know, tripping over themselves to buy the more hard music and the more
the music that we all considered, you know, bad for humanity.
The stuff that Tipper Gore got pissed off about.
You know, their role in that was to just spread it because it was financially feasible. There was no morality, just like there is no morality today.
But when you think about it too, Wendy, when we look at that era of music, we look at it with movies. We look at all our favorites like Commando, Bloodsport, Missing in Action, you know, Delta Force, Action Jackson, Die Hard, Rambo, Tango and Cash, a ton of them, you know, Above the Law, you know, Mark for Death. The 80s were the greatest time in terms of that over-the-top action genre of movies, just like the 90s.
The violence.
And I tell
them, right.
Yeah, and I tell anybody, I tell the youngest today, I'm like, it's one of the things that is so, you literally cannot explain it because it's indescribable.
Yeah,
it was a feeling, it was an air. Yeah, you had to have just been there to see it actually develop because you understood the enthusiasm, the anticipation, even with movies like The Neverending Story, Back to the Future, Star Wars, even in the 70s, I'll admit it. Care Bears, all of that, Charlie Brown, all of that stuff. Garfield, you know, Transformers, Voltron. Those were iconic definitions of 80s, not only 80s child nostalgia, but an encapsulation of the imagination, of the unlimited imagination, and going beyond the standard fare of what people thought. And that is something that cannot be replicated or duplicated even today because it was just one of those things. It came, it was lightning in a bottle, and then once, you know, that lightning went back into the essence, it was over with. You know, it was organic
right.
in its growth, and then it expressed itself. Now, also, too, when we thought, well, going back to what you were saying about how a lot of artists didn't always capitalize, they didn't know, well, they capitalized, but they didn't keep the capital. There were a few that kind of saw what, you know, they kind of saw the next outlet of entertainment. You know, LL and Run DMC with Crush Groove and Wildcats and Ernest did it first. And they damn sure
right.
weren't the last. Michael, you know, LL would be in that movie The Hard Way with Michael J. Fox and James Woods. You know, Will Smith would
yeah.
end up parlaying his popularity into doing Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Queen Latifah would have a bit part in Jungle Fever before she really, you know, broke out and started doing her, you know, her acting, you know, later on, you know, because she appeared on Fresh
right.
Prince, you know, in an episode. And, of course, the legendary Ice-T, he would end up doing New Jack City, you know, in 1991. Ice Cube would end up doing Boys in the Hood in that same year. And, of course, in 1992. Which is, of all the irony, and you know where I'm going with this, and King knows where I'm going with this, too. The man who wasn't even considered for the role at first, but ended up getting it, and he had already dropped his debut album in 1991 that was under the radar, which is why I have so many issues with a lot of these people who say they're fans of his but can't name it, because I already knew who he was when I first heard Trapped. When I first heard Tupac was lined up to do Juice back in 1992, because this is before, because it came out in the winter of 1992, of January, February, I was already a Tupac fan by then. When I found out this dude was going to do a movie, we're like, what?
Good.
I remember that.
And he wasn't even, and when the story was told about how he got the role, he wasn't even considered for the role at first, and he ended up getting it.
It was Tretch.
Yeah, exactly. And he went to the reading with Tretch, and they just let Pop read it and, you know, read the part. And I saw this on TV when they were talking about it. They were like, you know, they did their usual Hollywood stone face after they let him read it. Like, okay, we'll call you back. We liked it. After they closed the door, they're like, we got to get this motherfucker in here. It's like, we got to get him on. to watch Pac go from being a backup dancer with Digital Underground to, of course, dropping the... I tell people, if you listen to Tupacalypse now, you will really, really get a true appreciation for how talented that man was. Because that's between that and Me Against the World, those are probably my two favorite Pac albums, although all of them were great. What was it like watching Tupac start off his career and then your subsequent meeting you would have with him the first time?
It was amazing. I mean, when I first saw him in New York, I just liked him immensely. He was loud. He was obnoxious. He was, you know, I used to see him standing in line at the club. And whenever he came up, he was always with a large entourage. They were always trying to get to the front of the line. They were always loud and raucous. And it was just, like, there were many times where I'd see him come up and I would just get off the line and go home because I didn't want to be inside the club knowing full well that some shit was going to pop off because they were rowdy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They were rowdy and ratchet and loud. And I wasn't about that. I was going to the club because I wanted to hear music and dance. So I would kind of turn around and go home. And when I met him because I was trying to help him when he was attacked at Quad Studios. I knew that he didn't really have anybody on the East Coast he could turn to. And at the time I had a relationship with the Nation of Islam. So I called Brother Arthur from Fruit of Islam and asked him to help Tupac. And he did. And for me, that was kind of the end of it. You know, I didn't think that they would tell him that I had requested that. I really didn't think any further, to be honest. He was just this loud, obnoxious asshole in my eyes. And I was just doing what I felt was right as somebody that cared about artists. And I was worried about him as a rapper, you know. And
right.
He sent me a thank you. And he told me that it was nice to know that somebody liked his music so much that they were willing to go to bat for him. And when I read that, it really pissed me off because I really didn't like his music that much. You know, he wasn't as lyrical as my taste in music at the time. I thought he chose terrible production, and I found him obnoxious and loud, and he brought a lot of the drama that he was incurring, he brought to himself. You know, and that's how I truly felt. And he wrote me back. And when I saw the return address, my first thought was, uh-oh. Because I went hard at him. And I just thought I was going to get back a letter. Well, I didn't know he was going to write me back, to be honest. I thought he was just going to be like, fuck that bitch. And when I got the letter back from him, I thought he was going to just tell me off. And when I read the letter, it was the most intelligent and thoughtful letter that I had read. And maybe because he felt like I helped him when he needed help, that he couldn't just be like, yeah, fuck you, bitch. You know, maybe that's why he didn't come back at me hard. But he actually was trying to explain his point of view and how he was loud because that's what everybody expected of him. And that's what he thought he had to be to stand out and be a star. And the people that he was around, that's the type of personality they wanted him to be. And he pointed out that he's a man of many textures. And we all saw it. You know, we saw the Dear Mama Tupac. You know, we saw Hold Right. Your Head Up Tupac. And then we also saw, you know, shoot two cops in the ass Tupac. You know, we saw the two director twins. I forget their names now.
Alan and Howard Hughes from the Menace Society. Yeah, that Menace Society situation. Right. For those that know it. Yeah.
So we saw that Tupac. You know, he was very multifaceted, just like we all are. And
when I read his response, I was like, oh, shit, he's right. Like, I can't really be mad at him. I didn't agree with him on every point that he made, but he made some excellent points. So I wrote him back, and we had, like, a real, like, a discussion about that and then about life. And then he's like, you know, I love what you're doing with Rap Coalition, but you can't keep doing shit for free. People won't respect you. You've got to charge people. And I'm like, dude, I'm not going to charge people, because that was the whole point of me starting Rap Coalition, was to help people when they needed it. And he's like, yo, people find money for weed. People find money for the new Jordans when they drop. People find money for what's important to them. And my argument to him was, okay, yeah, I get that, but if people need help, help should not be prerequisite on whether you have money or not. And he didn't agree with me, but we agreed to disagree. But what I did agree with him on was, he said to me, you know how the African-American community is, and you know that if you want to grow faster and stronger and really get the coalition to the next level, you're going to have to be co-signed by people that know that you've got a good heart and people that know who you are and will stand up and say, okay, Wendy's for good. Wendy's not on some bullshit. And he said, you need to set up a board of directors or a board of advisors. And he's like, I'm going to lead that charge. I'm going to go out and get other rappers to, you know, to co-sign you. And I said, you know what? I love that, but I would love for you to be my first board of advisor, but if you don't mind, I would like to pick the board, because I want to make sure that I'm picking artists that genuinely care about other artists, not just people that are trying to be part of a coalition because they want free press. Because back then, you know, we had issues with artists that would do shit like charity work when the cameras were rolling because they wanted the press. Or
right,
they would
right.
shit, you know, that they believed in certain shit, like the 5% Nation, when they didn't, because that was the fad. So I wanted to make sure that anybody that touched my organization had my values and my morals, and he agreed with that. He thought that made perfect sense. So he was my first board of director, then Chuck D, then Vinny from Naughty by Nature, then Too Short. And then it just kind of, you know, it spiraled from there as my organization grew and people wanted to, you know, wanted to be helpful to the, you know, to the community. So he was absolutely right. Like, once he co-signed me, my company exploded in a good way.
And you know, it's funny, Wendy, because this is a situation, but because Pac still, he was known. At the time, you know, he was superstar status. One would even argue he was a superstar status. When you said there were so many textures.
Oh, yeah.
Maya Angelou told the story about when she was on the set for Poetic Justice and something had happened, and he had just went off and, you know, was just really upset about something, and she had to calm him down about it. People got to understand, in terms of Pac's family history, what that man represented in terms of coming from the Panthers. Yeah, and I mean, you figure basically, and we are going to say this on air, his family was basically hunted down by the laws his whole life. You
right.
know, I mean, you know, so this man, you know, I mean, you know, Mama Athene, Mama Asada, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, it's just so, there are just so much going on. You know, Matulu, you know, it was so much. And, you know, but to see where he started in 91 when he dropped his first album, and this is when he gets shot at Quad Studios, November 28, 1994. So you figure within really 3 years, he's done
what about he did Poetic Justice in 90. He has done two movies from 91 to 94, released what, 2-3 albums.
Then he did the movie Poet.
Like you said, yeah, you know, got away, like you said. Yeah, like he was saying, like you said, Wendy, an ass, you know, because they were, because they were harassing the black motorists, of which he got acquitted for. Now, mind you, this is the 90s, y'all, when this happened. And he got acquitted because it was self-defense. Exactly. So, I mean, his hood legend was, like, on another level after that. You know, so, I mean, so he was major. And by proxy, your movement became major. What did you start in the 90s begin to see with the music in terms of what was beginning to change? And then when you saw rappers doing the acting thing, and it becomes another dimension of the expression of black culture in not only entertainment, but business as well with the entertainment.
And that was such an awesome period in time because there was one year... Whatever year Boys in the Hood came out, there were 19 black movies that came out that year. And when I say black movies, I don't mean white funded with black faces. I mean really black movies where there were black directors and producers and even a little bit of ownership. You know, not completely, because it wasn't perfect. It was still the white corporations that had the money. But there was the Black Filmmakers Foundation, and there were, you know, Eddie Murphy was greenlighting films, and John Singleton was greenlighting films.
Yeah.
And even guys coming up like Matty Rich were
straight out of Brooklyn.
Were able to keep some ownership of their project. So it was a really amazing point in time, and I look at it now and like I get mad because it's changed. Like, it's no longer like black culture is more valuable today, but there are no more, I shouldn't say no more, there are very few black power players that are controlling budgets in music or in film.
It's
and it's
crazy
almost
when
like
you,
it's changed for the worse, not the better. And I thought it would have changed for the better.
And it's wild because when we think about this, once again, on Off the Cuff Radio, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, yes, we go in a lot of different directions. And we're going to go in this particular segment about all the, just some of the movies that came out during that time from 1990 to roughly 99. Obviously, we're not going to do all of them, but just a few. Okay, here's a short list. Fresh, Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, South Central, Jason's Lyric, Friday, you know. She's got to have it. That's 86 with Spike Lee. School Days, you know, Crooklyn. What else was out during that?
Love Jones.
I mean, you Love Jones. Thank you, King. Love Jones came out during that time. You know, it's Have Plenty. Caught Up. Vampire in Brooklyn. Sugar Hill.
Sugar Hill. My God. Yeah, Sugar Hill.
You know, Walking Dead. What else? What was it? Clockers. Damn, what was the other one? Trespass. You know, this is just a short list of, you know, and it's and to think about it once again, to see, and you saw, and I mean to see Bokeem Woodbine, Ice Cube, Cuba Gooding Jr., you know, to see, you know, Lila Rashawn, you know, you know, Lawrence Tate, you know, Alan Payne, Jada Pinkett. And who can forget, of course, that different world episode from 1991 with Vivica Fox and Jada Pinkett. Well, with Vivica Fox and Tupac guest starring on that is Jada's friend from Baltimore. you know, is Leela. You know, Lena, you know what I'm saying? A lot of people forget about that episode. I mean, even with the TV shows, Martin, Living Single, you know, I mean, Def Comedy Jam.
The Cosby.
The Black Renaissance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even the Cosby Show.
But we didn't know it. We didn't know it that we didn't know how short-lived it would be at the time. We thought, like, America was changing.
Right. Where do you think? Why do you think it stopped changing?
I think this is where it kind of like started, when you started seeing a lot of big money coming in. That's like in the late 90s.
Yeah. I can't speak about film because that's not my world, but I can tell you where we lost power in the 90s in music was the money came in. So a lot of folk that had ownership, like Andre Harrell with Uptown Records, like Puffy with Bad Boy, you know, even Master P, they sold ownership. Rap-A-Lot Records, they were selling like half of their companies for $80 million or $60 million or whatever, and they were selling out to the corporations, which would then run the brands. And they didn't have the same cultural affinity for the brand as the traditional owners, so it just became whitewashed, you know? And it lost power because it lost the cultural significance. And once the cultural significance was gone, the fan base dwindled. And once the fan base dwindled, it had no real financial value anymore. And once the value was gone, it's like, okay, well, that fad's over. What are we going to go, you know, what are we going to go buy next? Oh, Latin music? Reggaeton is big? Okay. Let's start
Daddy Yankee and all them, yeah. Tego Calderon, you know, although they've been around for years prior to. When we look at the 90s, when we saw Cash Money come in, because No Limit had pretty much, you know, because No Limit has already been a phenomenon if you really knew your music history,
but they
going
ran
back
the
to
course.
Richmond, California. Right. Right.
And in fairness, P played a role in that. He started playing basketball instead of running his company. And he left the company to be run by people that weren't necessarily qualified. Because I remember shopping the Cash Money deal in 1997, and my pitch to the labels was, this is the new No Limit. No Limit is over. Here comes the next No Limit. And I don't remember exactly where P started to lose interest in music, but I knew that I used it to help Cash Money get their deal.
You know, it's funny, Wendy, because I actually had that issue when P talked about it, and because that was where they kind of, the source alluded to it when they were interviewing him about it, and you know, and when we say this as a discussion, we're not downing P in any way. We're just talking real shit because we all know what happened during that time. You being an industry insider, us being journalists and reading it, and P said, you know, my next album. You know, because he was already at that time comfortable. He had already, you know, secured Cash Money's financial, you know, safety. So he said, you know, but the album, I think this is when he said, I think this is when Only God Can Judge Me was going to drop. And that's an album that was upcoming in 99. He had said, he had said, he's like, this next album, I'm going to make $47 million off of that. You think I don't got time to play basketball? And that was a dream he wanted to have. But, you know, and a lot of people were concerned at the time that, you know, while, you know, he did have a passion and he had a right to pursue it, what would be sacrificed in the process of that passion, you know? And, you know, of course, you know, there were some issues that was going on with him and Beast by the Pound at the time. You know, we won't get into that. That's for another show, another day. But there was just a change of going on at No Limit at the time where there was a lot of,
it wasn't the same from even what we had heard 2 to 3 years earlier. You know, I remember
right.
when I first heard about it, and I was like, oh, my God. I mean,
me being a fan,
you know,
I started seeing the changes on The Last Dime where I started hearing a lot of the songs he was doing. It kind of seemed like they was like remakes. Like he did Make
True
Him
that.
Say Un.
And I have that album. True that.
Then
True
he
that.
Did Let's Get Him Too. I'm like, you done did that for your last album. Now you're doing sequels now. Then he came up with Ain't My Fault Too.
Andy was signing everybody. Remember he signed Mercedes out of Detroit. Like he was signing everyone and everything that moved.
We were like, yo, this dude had like 10, I know, not 10, he had like 25 albums on the Billboard. We're like, yo, this dude was, man, look, Pen and Pixel was eating good during that time. That's where he was
playing
up everybody's up.
Had about 20 albums in the, booklet, ain't none of them dropped.
Yep. Oh man, I mean that bling era was just something
crazy.
When Cash Money got on after you, when you were at, how did the deal with Universal come about in terms of how were you finally able to lock that in terms of them saying, okay, we're gonna run with this? Because Birdman said, and I believe XXL some years ago when they did an interview with him, he said that deal we got with Universal, $30 million up front. He's like, you ain't never going to see nobody get a deal like that again.
Agreed.
So, tell us about that process of those negotiations, of what went on during that time, how you closed it.
Well, really, the success of that deal was based on two things. It was based on their leverage. They had
mm-hmm.
put out 31 albums over a six-year period. And so
right,
anywhere from 25,000 to... Right, 25,000 to 75,000 units every time they put something out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first reason that deal was amazing. The second reason was they let me say no for 9 months. And most artists don't have the ability to believe in themselves enough to do that. So the first offer was from Penalty Records through Tommy Boy. It was for just Juvenile, and it was for a $75,000 advance. And
what the hell?
It was kind of laughable because they were making so much money. You know, they were making $12 a CD, and they were putting music out every 6 weeks, just like Master P was. So, you know, they were being offered like 10% of what they were already making, and it just showed how ignorant the music industry was. That was in August.
Right.
That was maybe 2 weeks after they had brought me on board to shop their deal. And I realized that my job wasn't to really negotiate a deal. My job was to explain to the industry their value. So I put together a business plan and shopped them like they were IBM or Coca-Cola. I basically put together a plan that showed their genius, their ability to make money, and, you know, listed everything that they were doing. It had spreadsheets. It had everything. And I remember when I sent the plan to Mel LaWinter, and I sent it through my attorney. And Mel LaWinter, when he got the plan, he called the attorney and screamed at him at the top of his lungs. And then the attorney called me and said, well, thank you, Wendy. I just got screamed at by Mel LaWinter because you're asking for too much. I'm like, I'm not asking for too much. Like, if they're going to do a 50-50 deal, which is what we were looking at, and they were already making millions of dollars, why would they do a deal, give up half of their company, you know, in a joint venture, for, you know, less than half of what they were already making? It didn't make financial sense.
Absolutely
and
not.
When the lawyer said, okay, well, he just yelled at me, and I think you've destroyed my relationship with the president of Universal Records, thank you very much, I called the guys at Cash Money and said, okay, look, we've got to put out one more record right now,
and we've got to bump it up a notch, because at this point you're only selling between, you know, 5,000, 25,000, 30,000 CDs. So I had just come off of working with Twista and Do or Die in the Midwest. So I had like all of these relationships with retailers in the Midwest and DJs and, you know, basically the whole industry in the Midwest from the success of Twista and Do or Die. So when we put out that next record, we were able to get it to 75,000 units sold like within weeks. And when Universal saw that, and it's really hard to miss that on the charts, right? So
right,
when they saw that, Mel LaWinter called the lawyer back and said, you know, Peter, I might have been wrong. Like, I'm sorry that I overreacted, but I'm seeing them on SoundScan, and they're at 75,000 in a couple weeks. We want to meet with them. So they assigned it internally to Dino Duvalier, who was the A&R person. Dino called the lawyers and said, let's set up a meeting. And I said, no, we're not going to meet with Dino. We're going to meet with Mel, who yelled at you, and his boss, or we're not coming. And they wanted them so badly, they said, you know what? We'll make Doug available. We'll make Mel available, and we'd love to meet with them. And it went from being a joint venture that was a 50-50 split to an 80-20 split, because I brought in all the other major labels to out, you know, to bid against them.
That really was how you negotiate. Ooh.
Yeah, really it was successful because they let me just tell people no, 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 no.
And from that perspective of it, people have to understand, because Cash Money had been around since the early 1990s. 98 was when, you know, of course, the big introduction to the world came in. Juvenile's Ha, you know, of course, 400 Degrees
was,
that was the
opening. They started the label in 91.
Right, exactly.
They just didn't grow outside.
Yes, they must have,
they didn't grow outside. I'm sorry.
Y'all would say they was going to probably say, like, have, like, 40 or 50 underground releases.
They had 31 albums over the six-year period when I started to shop them. And they were only big in, really, Houston and New Orleans and the little towns in between, because that's where they were promoting.
That was
and
the Gulf Coast. I mean, definitely had UNLV and all them at the time.
Yes. I was able to bring them up into the Midwest and the Mid-South and bring them into, like, we had an 11-state area. They were only working two states when I met them. So by bringing them into nine more states, it put us into position to show Universal, okay, you think these guys aren't worth it? Watch. Here's what they can do when they step up their game just one notch. And then the lawyers that were my lawyers were also the lawyers for 3-6 Mafia. So the lawyers called 3-6 and said, okay, you guys are about to go out on the road. We're working with these new guys called Cash Money. Can they open for you? And 3-6 Mafia was like, fuck yeah, because they knew exactly who they were. And
would that
when
come to the collaboration later with Player Why You Hatin'? Would that end up how that began to come together?
Well, yeah, because they went out on the road together. So when Cash Money showed up, they showed up in a rap tour bus. And 3-6 Mafia were still moving around in, like, white vans. So it looked like Cash Money was the anchor act and 3-6 was the opening act. They weren't. You know, 3-6 was the was the anchor. But it looked bigger than life. So when the labels looked in, they all wanted a piece of that. They all wanted that deal. Every single label at that point was calling me saying, okay, we want to sign Cash Money. But at that point, the deal was already up to $3 million. And a lot of labels didn't see the value in paying $3 million. So we got it up to a $30 million deal. That was really the overall value. They were advanced $3 million in cash. And it was an 80-20 split, 80 to cash money, 20 to Universal. But by the time the deal was finalized, I went to Mel LaWinter and said, okay, everything signed. We just handed in the first album, The Masters, for Juvenile. Why did you guys do this deal? It doesn't make financial sense. And Mel LaWinter was kind enough to share with me that they did it for market share. You know, here's this label that's putting out so many releases every year, and Universal needed that at the time. They were struggling. So for them, the market share mattered to them as much as the money did. And that's when he shared with me, like he showed me the spreadsheet, and he said, okay, when we negotiate a deal, this is how we do it. You know, this is what the accountants say we can make on each CD, and then here's the forecast. If we're putting out six albums a year like Cash Money does, here's how much money we can make. And when I looked at that, I'm like, wow, I could have gotten more money. I could have gotten them to advance more money, motherfuckers. But that's where I learned that it's, you know, there's that financial spreadsheet. They know going into the negotiation exactly what they're able to spend.
The art of negotiation is a long and arduous one. Look, you remind me of that scene at War Dogs when they said, when they got that deal, they got the, you know, because them dudes basically got that deal, and they were like, you know, dead under bid. He's like, you basically lowballed the hell out of everybody. And then they found out they could have got that deal for like $50-some million.
Right, right.
And you know what? And you know what? We're talking about deals, too. And this is another part of the reason why I also want to bring you on, because you played a pivotal part of the culture. And on this show, we want your accolades to be acknowledged. Now, people have the notion to think that when, you know, he was representing Eminem, that he was rapping on 8 Mile and he magically landed a deal on Dr. Dre's desk, or his tape just magically ran in Dr. Dre's studio. But people don't know that you played a vocal role in helping him get his deal out there. Can you care to tell us?
Yeah. I had seen him rapping in Detroit. He was brought to my attention by a rapper called Rhymefest from Chicago. Rhymefest is the guy that wrote Jesus Walks for Kanye many years later.
Yeah.
Exactly. But this is when he was, you know, an up-and-coming rapper. And I was able to shop his deal, hit him meaning Eminem, and the labels just weren't responding. They were like, no, he's white, and we don't think there's room for a white rapper. And I got really frustrated. And it was at a time when lyrical rap as a whole was becoming less and less mainstream, less popular. Coming into vogue at that point in time was more gangster rap from the West Coast. You know, that was more the new type of music. And it was selling really well. So I wanted to do something where I could not only showcase Eminem and bring some attention to him to show the labels that people would positively respond to a white rapper, but I also wanted to bring lyrics into, you know, attention again. I wanted people to still love lyrical rappers the way that I loved lyrical rappers. So I did an event called Rap Olympics. It was in Los Angeles, and it was a rap battle, but it was different from most rap battles where it wasn't just one person against another person. It was teams battling. So I had a team, Wu-Tang had a team, KRS-One had a team, Project Blowed, which was a West Coast crew, had a team, and the teams were battling, and it was bringing attention to lyrics as a whole. And after Rap Olympics, there was also like a one-on-one battle, the way, you know, most battles went on. And Eminem came down to
to battling a rapper called, I think his name was Otherwise.
Juice. Oh, okay.
Not Juice.
Okay.
It wasn't Juice. Juice wasn't Juice involved, because at this point in time, Juice was winning every battle. And the fans loved him, but they were rolling their eyes. So Juice actually didn't battle. He performed, but he didn't battle. And
gotcha.
It came down.
Okay.
I think his name was Otherwise, and forgive me, it's been a really long time. So I hope I'm not screwing up his name. But he won. Eminem did not win.
Right. We know that part. He didn't win. Right.
Exactly.
And
part of the prize, like the first prize got fake Rolexes. They were bootleg Rolexes. And Eminem was kind of hoping he'd win because he wanted to sell the Rolex. And he was homeless. He wanted to get an apartment with the money, which is funny because we never said the Rolexes were real. We used to, you know, back then we used to call them fake Rolexes. Pretty much everybody had one. You could buy them in Chinatown for, you know, $200. But having said that, you know, my team came in second. Project Blode won. So Project Blode got the Rolexes. I think it was five of them that we gave out. And second place was they got to go on the Sway and Tech wake-up show. And Dre heard Eminem on that show. And he went up to the studio to see, you know, who is this rapper? Who is this person that's rhyming three- and four-syllable words? Like, every syllable is rhyming. Like, who the fuck is this? And he went up there and he met Eminem. And at the same time, I had tried to shop M's deal to Interscope. I got rejected twice by Jimmy Iovine's office. And I guess at the same time that Dre found M, Jimmy Iovine's nephew also found Eminem and brought him to Jimmy Iovine and said, yo, we need to sign him. So, you know, here's Jimmy Iovine having Dre, his biggest artist, saying, I want to sign this guy. His nephew saying, yo, we got to sign this guy. You know, I guess he's not a stupid man. And he said, okay, I get it. We got to sign this artist. And they ended up signing him. It took forever for Eminem to come out. I was really worried that he was going to get shelved. I don't know why it was taking so long. But it took over a year for the Slim Shady album to come out. And we were all really, was it Slim Shady or was it Marshall Mathers? I can't remember. But it took a really long time for that first album to come out. And we were worried that he was going to get relegated to the, you know, to the garbage pile inside the label. Like, oh my God, they signed him and they're not going to put him out. That's crazy because he's so talented. And
you know,
of course, no question about his talent.
Yeah, you know, and people forget, you know, about Infinite that he dropped in 1996. It was a self-financed record. And if you listen to it, the potential was there at the time.
Right.
It was a when we think about Eminem today, his ascent, his journey was of hardship, obstacles, resilience, determination, and ultimately culminating in overcoming. Because he was like that guy who just kept going no matter what and never got angry for what – well, I'm sure he got angry, but he never gave up. And lyrically,
not
you
ever.
Could just see the growth. He was determined to make it, and he did. This is a kid that dropped out of school in like 8th, 9th grade. He'll tell you that. You know, he dropped out of high school and devoted his full time to rapping. And side note, this is what I tell everybody. There's, you know, because if I believe Busta Rhymes didn't finish high school, and we're not saying this to shade anybody, we're just saying this because these are legends, yes, but they put in a sacrifice that a lot of people don't understand the risk that's involved. And they succeeded. But by the same token, all I can say is you better be damn good knowing that you can make it, you know, because those guys are special. And they made it.
Agreed.
But I would not endorse anybody. I'll tell anybody, learn as much as you can in terms of the formal education, because that is what will take you further when you get into business negotiations. Once you have any education, any academia you attain is an addition. It is not a subtraction. Subtraction is lack of knowledge and even can be deadly from deficiency of cognizance.
Right.
And personality,
you,
too, because, you know,
yeah,
you got to have, like, you gotta be somewhat likable. Like,
yeah, you gotta be charismatic.
Go ahead.
You've gotta be charismatic. People have
yeah.
to wanna be you. You know? Snoop Dogg said it best. He said, to be a star, women have to wanna sleep with you and men have to wanna be you. And
exactly.
I think that's perfectly.
I mean, Uncle Snoop got that wisdom and had it for a long time. And when we look at what M became, man, I mean, this dude not only became a star, he became an icon, you know, and has never sacrificed his credibility, you know. Did being white help? Of course, because he influenced a whole another generation of hip-hoppers. He was their voice, and he was not ever he was never a person who culturally appropriated or fabricated. Him is about as real for the culture as it comes, and we respect him as such.
Agreed.
And we will tell
you
anybody.
You know, he was to black culture. He's never been on mm-hmm. BET. He was always marketed to white kids. He was like what Post Malone is today. Not in terms of talent, but in terms of how he was marketed. He was never brought
yeah.
into the market. He was always a pop star.
But musically, when you listen to him, he's every bit of an MC. And we'll still
he's
tell anybody
every
today.
Bit of an MC, and he's every bit pro-black, and he's pro-hip-hop. And he talks about the culture, and he respects the culture. And he talks about the history. And he matters to us.
One more thing, too, we got to mention. We still tell people there's a big-ass caution sign around him and with a radioactive sign on it, which says, do not battle this man, ever.
Right, ever. Ben Dino.
Ooh, there's a few rap carcasses that he threw in coffins from those compositions. You know what I'm saying? So it's like... Yeah, but that man, I mean, a Grammy winner, movie star, you know, a proud ambassador for the culture. When
I
you
want
look
you
at
this
it now,
question too, Wendy, I want to ask you this now. Do you care to name an artist outside of Cash Money that you felt that got away, like someone that you feel could still be here if they had the right situation?
Joyner Lucas.
That's interesting. Please tell us.
Yep, Joyner. And this isn't really fair because I'm not in his circle. I don't know his business, so he might be a multimillionaire, and I don't know that. But I think that if he had a better situation at a label, I think he could be a superstar. And again, that's not to take away from where he is. You know, he could be perfectly happy for all I know. You know, maybe this is what he wanted, but if I have to look at somebody that got away, I look at him. You know, Slim Thug. Slim Thug's another one. I always wished I could have done a deal for him, because he was a superstar in the South when he was independent. And I feel like once he signed his deal, either the label didn't know what to do with him. I just feel like he was bigger when he was independent. And I feel like when he signed, he lost something. I don't know. And through no fault of his own. I'm not blaming
him. Because I have already platinum when he signed with Star Trek, and the album is a banger, but it didn't get the love that it should have, you know. But it was a banging ass record.
And it didn't get the love that he was getting on the street before he signed the deal.
Like, to me, he was as big as Cash Money after Cash Money. And I always wanted to do a deal for him, but never could get close enough to, you know, to share my vision of him or with him.
But you get, right, and you got to remember, too, at that time, Wendy, this was during the time in the mid 2000s where that whole Houston thing, once again, we saw another phase of it. This is when Houston began to start blowing, you know, in terms of where you had Chamillionaire, you had Paul Wall, you had Shingo Bling, you know, UGK was really getting, you know, coming off, you know, that feature with Big Pimpin' with Jay-Z, you know, that shot them up levels. And but if you already, but I knew about them going back to their first album, Too Hard to Swallow. I knew them.
Yep.
I knew them back on the Minister Society soundtrack, Pocket Full of Stones. If you really go deep, you think back to their first album, The Southern Way. You know,
they were on Down South Hustlers. Master P put out a compilation album called Down South Hustlers, and they were on that.
Right. So it's like they were, but that whole Houston scene at that time was Zero and Slim Thug and all Mike Jones and all. I mean, it was just, you know, it was, you know, the Screwed Up tapes, you know, with DJ Screw that he invented. You know,
yep.
It was like the culture was already set down there. It was once again
Little
just like
Flip.
The bounce sound. Yeah, Lil Flip, Lil Kiki, Southside, you know what I'm saying? Fat Pat, Big Hall.
Kiki was another
know,
one. I think Kiki could have been a star.
When I first heard Southside, I was like, this shit slaps.
Yep.
I still
he could have
yeah,
been a super
single.
Yep. There's so many artists I feel that got away. Psychodrama from Chicago. They were signed to Suave House, and I think they could have been superstars. It was two guys and a female rapper, and that you know, other than Diggable Planets, that wasn't really heard of.
The norm,
and,
right.
And I think, you know, their music was amazing. You know, I worked with Twisted and Do or Die, but my favorite group out of Chicago was Psychodrama. I thought they were stars. I think they could have been far bigger than they were. It's just, you know, circumstance. Shit happens. Either it's the label or the artist self-destructs or the team isn't right. You know, there's a million reasons why artists don't get from A to Z. And, you know, unless you're there on the inside, you can't really speculate as to what happened. You just know that something happened. And that's what I feel about everybody that I've mentioned. I think they're all incredibly talented. I think they've all done really well for themselves. You know, I don't think that anything's wrong with the careers they had. But I'm just answering the question, like, the ones that could have been bigger than they were or are.
We got a little bit of time left, but we definitely got so much because we got to do a part two of this. So we're just going to try to wrap up this part one as best we can. When you see, when
yeah,
artists
hey,
come to the game,
I got another question that was shot to me.
Sure.
I want to know, who do you feel has the most valuable catalog in hip hop?
Oh, wow. Great question.
Probably Cash Money, because their reign lasted so long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the deal was done in 98, and they stayed hot all the way through Drake and Nicki Minaj.
That's 2009. That's going past 2000. That's going into, like, 2012.
That's a really long. That's a longer run than Bad Boy. That's a longer run than Death Row. It's a longer run than No Limit. Like, for, you know, for an independent label in hip-hop, that's amazing. So I'd probably have to say that. Drake probably has a really valuable catalog. NBA Youngboy. Or Youngboy Never Broke Again, whatever, you know, whatever they want to call him this week.
a really valuable
catalog. Future has a valuable catalog. It's based on income, and it's based on
usability, and that's not really the right word. I just don't know the word that I'm looking for.
Viability.
It's based on the whoever purchases the catalog, their ability to get people to reuse songs. So
mm-hmm.
hit records matter, samples that are ear-friendly matter. So I'm probably missing artists that have those things that I'm not even considering right now. But if I were going to buy catalogs, those are the ones I'd go after in hip-hop.
I mean, and we can't argue because it's definitely about what's moving, you know, with this generation.
Yeah,
when artists
and
come
fans,
into the game, when,
like what matters.
Yeah, exactly.
What I think
when artists
doesn't,
come,
doesn't matter an iota.
Right. When artists come to the game, Wendy, how important is it for the right people to be around them in terms of keeping the grifters away and the gifters who really want to gift them with genuine support and good conscience? Because we see a lot
it's
of times
super important.
Mm-hmm. Please, go
I've
ahead.
I've seen artists keep their original teams and have excellent success because the connection is there, the relationships and the experience. It's
right,
like they're all
right.
stepped on the same foot at the same time. And then I've seen artists do the opposite, get on, fire their entire team. Trouble is a perfect example of that. When we did Trouble's deal at Interscope, you know, that
right.
was an $8 million deal over a 3-year period. And I, as soon as he got signed, I felt like my job was over and I went on to work with other artists. And the guy that I was dating at the time stayed on, but instead of Trouble putting him in a position of power, he brought back his old manager from the early 2000s. And this guy didn't have the experience. He didn't have the likability at the label. And
right,
he didn't really
right.
understand the business. And Interscope really tried to work with him for about 6 months, and then they kind of gave up because they couldn't do what they needed to do in order to be successful. And when you're signed to a label with, you know, 20 other artists and you're hard to work with and somebody else is easy and grateful, it's not hard to figure out what they're going to do. You know, they're it's human nature. People that work at record labels are people. So
exactly.
they're going to stop focusing on the problem, let the problem sit there, and they're going to move on to somebody that's easier to work with, who does what needs to be done and has a team of people that understand. So the sad part about Trouble is his career faltered because he surrounded himself with the wrong people. He became
you know,
too hard to work with.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing about it is this is what people have to understand about it. This is a business before anything else. And when people a lot of times, and I'm serious, it's cancer when I say this, because they will kill your career if you got the wrong people behind you. Because a lot of people look at this, if you got the wrong people around you, they're looking at about how they're going to get paid behind you.
Yep.
You're the artist. You're the one that's got, you're the talent that's bankable. But then you got the leeches and the snakes who are going to come up, you know, and then they're going to try to, they're either going to put their fangs in you, get a financial gain, or they're just going to leech off of you and not do anything. You know,
and it's not even evil. Like, sometimes it's just ineptitude. Like, sometimes people hire people where their intentions are good. They're not evil. They're not evil people. They're
just
not.
They just don't know the situation.
Yeah, they're not good at what they do. So they fuck shit up unintentionally, but it still ends the career. And like I said,
definitely.
It's too easy for a label to go on to the next artist. It's like, okay, you're difficult to work with. Your team is difficult to work with.
None of y'all know what you're doing. So you know what? We're not going to be successful. We'll just move on to the next artist until you get your shit together. And if you don't, then we'll just take the loss because we'll make it back on a superstar.
Hmm. On that note, because we got to go and we do not want Brawl Talk to cut us off.
Dope show.
Absolutely. Wendy,
thank you for having me. This was not only fun, but I really love what you're doing. I really support what you guys are doing. You don't make money doing this. You're not getting rich doing this. You're doing this because you love it. And thank you.
Wendy, when we can get legends like you on the show, it makes it all the more worthwhile. And
I'm so
I mean, we've been blessed to do this, and we're going to keep going. Wendy, you got to come back for part two whenever you're able, because we got so much more we got to discuss.
I would love that.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Wendy,
guys.
We love you.
I had a really good time.
Thank you, Wendy. We love you so much.
Always.
Come back as soon as you can.
Tell people where they can find you.
On Instagram, at Rap Coalition. And if you need to find me faster than that, WendyDay.com.
Absolutely. Y'all heard it here.
Already, man. We definitely appreciate you joining us. We appreciate anybody that's took the time to listen to the show. Big shout out to Pat for calling in. Big shout out to people that were sending me questions. And big shout out to you, Wendy, for building with us and giving us insight of what this music business is. Class is set.
Thank you, love. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Thank you again. Peace, love, and blessings to you, the whole universe. OTC, we are signing out. We will see you again Friday with John Blaston Game of Word Up Magazine. And
awesome.
We are out.
Already. Yes.
Yep.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, guys.